Let's begin by taking a biblical and theological frame of reference by looking at Genesis chapter 2 and starting with the latter part of verse 4. When the Lord God made the universe, there was no plants on the earth, and the seas had sprouted because he had not sent rain. And then moving down to verse 7, then the Lord took some soil from the ground and formed a man. Out of it, he breathed life, giving breath into his nostrils. The man began to live. Then the Lord God planted a garden in Eden, in the east, and there he put the man he had formed. He made all kinds of beautiful trees to grow there and to produce good fruit. In the middle of the garden stood the tree that gives life and the tree that gives knowledge of all what is good and what is bad. We'll stop there and ask that God will add a blessing to the reading of the word and that it will reach the depths of our hearts. We're talking about maintaining a journal. And how many of you were in the class the first time around? Let me see a show of hands. So I'm going to be a little redundant, so just bear with me. It's sort of like the preacher who was called to this church, and it was just an outstanding sermon. And so the next Sunday he came back and he preached the same sermon. This went on for several Sundays. And finally, some of the deacons or elders, officers of the church got together, went to the preacher and said, "Preacher, that's a fine sermon, but don't you think it's time to move on to something else?" And the preacher responded, "When you act on that sermon, then we'll move on to something else." There is a place for redundancy and repetition. And we sing the same hymns, we say the same prayers over and over again. And it's amazing how much we miss, even after repetition, doing it over and over again. So we're talking about maintaining a journal. We said, in essence, that there are no rules in terms of maintaining a journal. The only rule is to write. It doesn't have to make sense. You don't have to have good grammar. You don't have to know how to spell. It's for you. And we say to you that you're in the driver's seat. You're in control. And that's important to remember, because many times the hesitation is, am I following the rules? Well, as long as you're following your rules, it's okay. So the ideas that I share with you are not in concrete. They're pretty much some of the rules I've established for myself. And one of the rules I have established for myself in maintaining my journal is complete honesty with myself. And I find that I break that rule all the time. I'm not completely honest with myself. There is much that I hide from. And I have discovered that those things that I hide from are the very things which will potentially help me to grow in spiritual leaps and bounds. And so it's a real, real struggle, to be honest. And so we said we have a J car, and the J stands for what? Those of you who, this is the quiz right now.
Journal.
Okay, and the C is for what?
Connection.
And that's what we're going to talk about today. And tomorrow we're going to talk about the A, which is?
Affirmation.
Affirmation. Very good. We have a smart class. And the R is?
Recreation.
Recreation. That's right. So that's the J car. Those are the basic principles. And you're in the driver's seat. You decide where the car is going to go. But remember now, folks, as you're driving and deciding where you're going to go, you don't travel alone. You travel with people. You travel with family. Your family could be your cat and your dog and yourself. It could be your neighbor across the hallway. It could be a variety of number of combinations of people that you are on a regular association with. But we're not made in, to be to ourselves. God made us to be in relationship with one another. And so whoever happens to be where we're in relationship with one another, that happens to be our family. And so right now we're in a much larger family as we come here to Holden. And so we are constituted as a family. And so as we journey in our J-car, we journey with a family. You remember that story about the family of J-car and what happened. And we had some people who were really sleeping on the job, and there were some people who were drinking, some were fighting. And for those of you who don't know the story, I just tell it very quickly. It was a family who was on a journey together in a car and had an accident, but on the dashboard there was a sign which read, "In case of an accident, please notify my brother." And the sheriff went to the scene. Sure enough, there was a terrible accident, and he called the brother, and the brother said, "Well, where's the chimpanzee?" And because that chimpanzee is just like a family member. And if you can find that chimpanzee would tell you what happened in the accident. And the sheriff found the chimpanzee. He said, "Well, what happened? What happened?" He said, "What was the father doing?" Drinking. He said, "What was the mother doing?" Sleeping. He said, "What were the children doing?" Fighting. He said, "Now, what were you doing?" Don't let anybody drive your car. I mean, you, in terms of maintaining a journal, you're in the driver's seat. And if you don't drive it, somebody else will take you somewhere where you don't want to go, will have an accident, kill everybody in the car, and we will live to tell the story. So it's important that the rules that you establish are your rules. And but you travel with people, and there are people, and it's not always a pleasant trip, is it, as you journey?
Not always.
A lot of times you have fighting in the family. You have people who are just tired and want to rest. You have people who are lazy. One of the biggest problems I have found as families, people travel along their own journey, is alcoholism. Major problems. One of the biggest secrets with families is the problem of incest. There are major problems as we travel along that we have to address as we journey together, because those problems can become opportunities for spiritual growth for ourselves. If we're brave enough to look at them for what they are. And, the confession part is the most difficult part in terms of maintaining a journal. I have to tell you that right now. It's tough. It's tough being honest with yourself. It's tough about being honest with your stuff. It's very easy to blame others for stuff. It's just very tough to be confessional. Last evening, we had a prayer of confession. You remember the prayer of confession we had last evening. It was a good prayer of confession. General, but it was a good one. And as I said to you the other day, that for every general confession that we make, we will receive a general blessing from God. That's true. The AA program taught me that. But every specific confession, as specific as you can make it, you will receive a specific blessing from God. I have found that to be absolutely true. And so that's the challenge before me as I try to maintain a degree of honesty in my journal. I know that if I can really get to the real heavy-duty stuff, that God's going to bless me in a very sort of specific sort of way. And that's what I'm going to be looking for. And that's the challenge. And that's the payoff. Now, when you make confessions, as I try to explain to people, you confess your sins and not the sins of your spouse, your children, your neighbor. I mean, it's very easy to confess somebody else's sin. I mean, that's no problem at all. I can tell you all the things that's wrong with my spouse or my children. But that's not what we're talking about. And if you see a lot of confessions in your journal about other people, and which I do, I go through and I say, well, I'm confessing a lot of people's sins here, and I know that I'm avoiding something. You see, you have to make those I statements. And the way to get this started, again, I said one of the things I mentioned to you the other day is the importance of writing and recording, but you don't always have to write. You can draw pictures. And I'm not an artist. I try to draw pictures to help me because I can go to the picture and I know immediately what I'm talking about. And yesterday, the other day when I talked to you, for those of you who have not seen it, in order to make sense of what we're doing today, I drew a picture of the J car and the people I'm traveling with, you know. So when I look at that, I know exactly what it's all about. I'm talking about my journal, I'm talking about confession, I'm talking about affirmation and recreation. And that guy right there is me, because I'm in the driver's seat. You know, we're going to have a safe trip. So today I wanted to draw a picture. I said, well, if I had to put this thing in the picture about what we're going to talk about today so that people can sort of remember it, how would I do it? And so I have to tell you the story first. Then I'll show you the picture. But I'm not an artist, but I think you'll get the idea. Some years ago when I went to a seminary after college, I was very, very small, very frail. And I promised that once I finished college and got off the seminary that I would indulge myself. And I did. Within a period of about 6 months, I picked up about 50 pounds. And you can do it because I can give testimony to that. But I still had a skinny mind. All my life I've been skinny. You couldn't tell me that I was fat. But as long as I was rationalizing with myself, I couldn't do anything about my overweight. And one day I was walking from the classroom building to the administration building and was going through a doorway. And the doorway served as a mirror. You know how it is when you walk up. And I said, whoa, who's that fat man? And you know what I did? This is true. I literally closed my eyes. I did not want to see. It was so disgusting. This is terrible. And then I gradually opened up my eyes, and it was still there. I was what I call a fat Tyrone with a skinny mind. And so this is my picture here. I'm not an artist, but when I turn to that, I know what it means. That means that sometimes my self-perception is not in accord with reality. And when we are confessional, we have to be very honest with ourselves if we choose to do something about it. And at some point I did open up my eyes and I said, yeah, that is a fat Tyrone. And so the next question is, well, what are you going to do about it? And I said, well, I'm going to be honest about it. Right now I'm not going to do anything about it. I'm just going to accept the reality now that I'm fat. And maybe somewhere along the way I'll choose to do something about it, which I did. But I did it on the time scale that I felt that was comfortable with me. I don't think God is calling us to do anything more than we're able to do. And God will assist us in doing that. But we have to be honest with ourselves if we are to grow. And so as I talk about the J card, the most challenging part about this card is the confession. It really is. As I mentioned, we come together and worship. We confess our sins in a very general sort of way. But we must have a forum where we can be specific in our confessing of sins. And every time we make the confession, the stronger we become. I found that to be true. At our General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church, we have what we call, we don't have bishops in our system, but we have moderators who are elected to serve 1 year. And our moderator told the entire assembly of 600 people that once he was elected to serve as moderator, he went back to smoking cigarettes. And, you know, he just really felt bad about that. But he made a commitment to the entire Presbyterian Church that after 3 months of this assembly that he would stop smoking again. Whoa! What about that? I mean, your family is one thing, but when you tell your entire Presbyterian family, I mean, you can't go any place in the world. I mean, what can this poor guy smoke a cigarette? But I thought that was very responsible because he used his family to help him, number one, to be confessional, and number two, to hold him responsible. See, our family is there to help us as we go along in our journey to be responsible for becoming a better human being. They're just there to remind us. Sometimes we don't like to be reminded, but I mean, we are the ones that initiated this, and so we're the ones that ultimately are responsible for it. Let me share with you very briefly. This was an easy confession, by the way, for me. It was, no confessions are easy, but some are easier than others. So I just put it that way. But there was one that was very difficult, and I have confessed this many times. And every time I confess it, the more I find myself growing spiritually. It's just amazing. And again, and I'll get back to this in a moment, I got this basically from the AA program in their fifth steps. I'll say some more about that in a little bit in terms of how do you do it. But I was a pastor for a number of years, 9 winters, as I say, in St. Paul, Minnesota. And it was a very interesting congregation. I was the first African American to be called to that church. And I just flat out asked, I said, why are you looking at an African American pastor? Because church was 90% white. And so, well, we're not really looking for African American pastor, we're looking for a qualified pastor. Made a real impression upon me. I didn't believe them, but it made a real impression. So I accepted the call there and stayed there long enough to really discover racism and prejudice and bigotry at some of its most sophisticated levels. It's just really, really amazing how that's one of the most damaging things to our world and to our church is racism. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so important for us to be confessional about it. But I'm not here to confess other people's sins. I'm just here to confess my own sins about that. Our church was intentional about being very, very inclusive. It was, in retrospect, as I look back, it's just amazing. We were the first church in Minnesota to sponsor a refugee family from Laos, a Hmong family. And the church went into, we were talking about what is God calling us as the church to do in response to the bold people. What is God calling us to do? Send money or help somebody else, or what are we to do? And the session, or the governing body, was responsible for making some type of decision about that. My personal belief was that, and I, fortunately, I kept it to myself. I said, with all these people who are natives to America, and native Americans and blacks and others, right in this immediate community, why are we going to go on the other side of the world to find somebody to help? It just didn't make sense to me. I said, we have all the lives that we can touch right here. But something just would not allow me to share that with the session. And so we did call a family, and we did everything for that family. We gave them a home. We put clothes on their back because they just came with things on their back. We gave them food, jobs, and everything. And one of them, or two of them, we gave a job as a custodian in the church. Over time, it's just amazing how people really acclimated themselves and just grew to self-reliance and independence. It was just amazing. And when I was about to leave the church, they did several things to honor me. And I had to serve all the people of the church as best I could as pastor. And this one family, the Hmong family that we sponsored, came up to give some words of farewell and thanksgiving for my ministry to their particular family. And Su Vong said, he said, Reverend Burkett, we will always remember you. And he went through a whole litany of things that I had service of my ministry to him and to his family, things I had forgotten about. And he said, and my children will always remember you. And my children's children will always remember you. And at that point, I just held my head down in shame, because I was the very person who did not want him to come. And then I lifted my head and I saw within Sue the forgiving power of God. I just felt forgiven. That was very, very profound for me, theologically. But I say to myself many, many times, suppose for some reason I was not intentional in terms of my own confession, of my own sin, of my own bigotry, of my own prejudice, I would have missed that blessing. And every time I share that story, it's emotional for me right now just even to share that, because I can still see his face, and I'm reminded of God's grace. You see, and so it's important for us to maintain a journal so that we can be reminded of those sort of things. And for years, I had a picture of Su Vong in my office so that whenever I saw him, instantly, I would be reminded of my own bigotry, of my own prejudice. And it helped me to understand what God is calling me to be, because as I understood ministry initially, was just confined or very restricted who was a part of the family of God. And Sue helped me to understand that it opened up the whole universe. So basically, that is why I think the confessional part is very, very important. Now, getting back to family, and we want to allow some time for us to talk and engage. God called us to be together, to learn from each other. And first, we are to learn from ourselves, because we are to love ourselves, because we can't love our neighbor as ourselves until we love ourselves. I mean, that's logical. But next to ourselves, God is calling us to grow as a result of God's blessings is in relationship with our family, our spouse, our children. and those we're in daily contact with, they are the ones which will instruct and teach us to how to grow as full human beings and to grow spiritually. Who can tell me the first dysfunctional family? First dysfunctional. So much sin in the first few chapters, it's just amazing. You really take a look at it. That's heavy duty stuff. Yet God created a paradise for them to enjoy together. And they couldn't enjoy the paradise because of their own sin. Immediately they lost sight. We talked about the senses, and we're going to get back into that. But you can't see, and you can't hear, and you can't taste. You cannot experience what God is sharing with us because of that blockage that results from sin. See, so we're talking about confessing our sins. And what happened between that in that relationship, that sacred relationship between the first man and God was, and there, let me just briefly just go back to the text, because there are two creation stories there. In the first creation story, the man and the woman are created at the same time. The entire universe was made, and then God said, hey, here it is for you to enjoy. And the second one was far more interesting, because human beings become co-creators. The male was made first, and then the female, and they named the animals and took responsibility for the creation. And it's interesting to go back and look at that, to compare and contrast it. But what happened initially with Adam and Eve? What was the problem? What happened to them that caused them to fall into sin and need to be confessional? Well, very simply, so we move on, because you already know this, I know. Eve succumbed to the serpent, and Adam succumbed to Eve's, also partaking of the fruit. And God has come along and say, hey, what's happening? What's going on? Nothing. Ain't nothing happening, Lord. But wait a minute, when you got clothes on, you're hiding. Why are you hiding? We didn't do nothing. Denial. We didn't do nothing. What happens after denial? Well, Lord, you know that woman you made me. She made me do it. She made me. Then, of course, Lord, you know that snake is so smart. I was minding my own business. You don't want me to back this up. You hear this kind of stuff in families all the time. People not taking responsibility for their own behavior. I call them CBs, complain, blaming people. CBs. And as long as you're a CB, you're not going to grow spiritually as long as you're complaining and blaming and not assuming responsibility for your behavior. And the whole thing with Cain and Abel was what? Jealousy. And if we are jealous of one another, it blocks us spiritually. And so again, we're called to be, to ask God's, first we're called to confess and ask for God's healing power to come into our lives so that we can rid ourselves of that. And as serving as a pastor, I have discovered that the 12-step programs of AA to be very, very helpful. And I was very naive. People would come to you all the time seeking help. And I referred families to AA people. And they came back to me and they would say how wonderful the program was. And I said, what do you mean, program? Well, they told me about the 12 steps. And since that time, I've had people to come and do fifth steps and etc. That confessional part, you acknowledge the exact nature of your wrongs, the exact nature of the fifth step, if you know what I'm talking about. You have to confess it with another human being. It's not enough to confess your sin to yourself. I mean, that's a starting place. But you have to confess the exact nature of your wrongs with another human before you can begin to feel the healing power of God and the grace of God. So that's why I mentioned before, when I talk about sin, I first discover my stuff in here, but then I have to share this with other people, my own, whatever the stuff happens to be at that particular time. So that, in a nutshell, is what we're talking about when we say confession. And let me quickly just put this, just J-Car back together, because I like for things to be in context. We're talking about maintaining a journal of our spiritual pilgrimage. We travel together with other people, namely the family. And the C is for confession. The A is what we're going to talk about tomorrow, affirmations. That's the good stuff. That's real nice stuff. And the R is recreation, playing together. So let's get in some dialogue now and some reaction from you and some questions that you may have. Please. Yes.
In just a couple sentences, I wanted to affirm this process of experiencing how God heals and how God presents grace. I was here at Holden over Easter, and the pastor invited us, instead of a sermon, for people to talk about what God had been doing in their lives. And everybody started telling these wonderful stories. But then one person told something very private and very hurtful to himself, very honest. And something clicked in me, and I was the next person to talk. And I confessed that I've been hiding from the fact that I'm an oppressed person. And there was so much interest after the service during the following days that I gave a service a week later on what it's like to be depressed. And don't tell our secrets, because the secrets hold the power over us.
Oh yeah.
So I just wanted to affirm
that. I appreciate you sharing that affirmation. It's, again, as I shared with the group on Monday, the story of the feeding of the 3,000 or the 5,000. One of the interpretations I've heard about that, in terms of they had no food, and now here's one little boy is coming to Jesus, and he's going to share his food, and then all of a sudden everybody has food, more than they can handle. And the interpretation is this, that they all had food from the very beginning. They were just too selfish or too self-centered to share what they had with the rest. And once this one person was brave enough to share, to open up, everybody else they were given permission to do that. And that's the wonderful thing about confession. It really is. That once you make a confession, you give others permission to confess. And again, we can't overstress the importance, and when you're in community, the importance of confidentiality, that what is confessed stays in that particular family. And they stays in that particular community. Because if the person is confessing, there's something therapeutic and spiritual that's taking place. It's only when it's not confessed then you need to have some outside, I think, intervention, in my experience, where something must happen. Thank you.
I was just thinking back to what you said about the fifth step and the 12 steps for the AA program, and how interesting it is that in this program and other substance abuse programs, the people who are involved do have that space to confess and share those deeply personal things, but you almost dare not do it in the congregation of your church.
Isn't that ironic? Isn't that ironic that we can't do it in the church?
Yeah.
Just so ironic. Just so ironic. And I think that is a major criticism I think people have. I know people who go to AA and won't miss a meeting but won't come to church because of that.
Yeah.
Please. please.
I think you hit on two things, though, the reason why, because I have found that within the context of a 12-step group, what's happening is everybody there, by just the fact that they're present there, is saying, I have a problem, and I'm here to deal with it. So they're starting from a point of honesty. Everybody knows it, or else you wouldn't be there. Whereas I think sometimes people have a feeling when they go to church that they're saying, I'm all better, I'm well, I'm whole, I'm here just to say I'm happy, or something like that. So people sometimes don't feel like they can be honest. And I know I had the experience once with a very close group of friends who had been going through a 12-step group, and we were at like a retreat. And it was a very small group of friends I've known for 15 or two more years. And we were supposed to tell how we were feeling, and at that moment, I was feeling bad. I mean, really bad. And so I thought, well, okay, everybody before me was being very, you know, upbeat, and I thought, I have a choice. Am I going to be honest, or am I going to go along with the program? And I said, well, I think I'm going to risk it. I'm going to be honest. So I said how I was feeling, and everybody was horrified. Like, their mouths went, and they all tried to fix me. And this is the other side of it, where people don't want you to be honest because it makes them so uncomfortable. And it was really a very painful experience for me. But I think that it was good that I did it, because later on it opened up a lot of other things that came out of that. But it took a process of maybe a year for people to work that through, because they said, well, gee, we always came to you. You were always a strong person. You know, you always were that person. Why are you the one that's now talking like this? So it's very risky to be honest, even in confidential, trusted relationships sometimes.
I'm serving now as pastor of a dysfunctional church. More than the average. More than average. And you know their most the biggest criticism they have of me.
You're too honest.
I'm too honest. I'm too personal. They're not interested in my confessions or my personal journey, because what? If I preach in the first tense, then you have to listen in the first tense, first person, if you follow what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. They'd rather for us to be nebulous and obscure. Mm-hmm. We actually have obscure classical music, not the regular, but obscure classical music performed every Sunday by paid soloists. Mm-hmm. It's a highly dysfunctional church that shuns intimacy. And if you try to become intimate, if you try to become personal, the very threat, because you're reminding me, you're helping me to get in contact with stuff that I don't want to get in contact with, and so I resent you for that. But to some degree, churches are like that. And the 12-step program, as you walk in the door, is you're confessing that you're a broken person.
That's right.
Lyman Coleman, are you familiar with Lyman Coleman Small Group Ministry? He's outstanding in doing that type of ministry. Talks about his own church home. And the most broken person in the church is the pastor. Which should be the case. I mean, in terms of sharing brokenness, and if the pastor can do that, then everyone else in the congregation obviously is given permission to do that, to share their brokenness. You look at the people, the biblical persons in the Bible, and you look think about the brokenness there. Look at the Apostle Paul and his brokenness. And yet God was able to use him more than most.
How about David?
Oh, what about David? Yeah. Whoa.
Yeah, right.
What about David? Yeah, that's the whole thing. I mean, God doesn't use perfect people. I mean, he used us in our brokenness. But we have to confess our brokenness.
With my feet, too.
Like Peter. Yeah.
It's my favorite.
Yeah.
All of them.
That's right.
I had an experience this past winter. I shared with a person in our church some medical problems I was having. happened to be a man, and we were both single, and he, it was depression and that type of thing, and so he had already told me he was depressed, and I thought, okay, it's safe to tell him I'm depressed. Immediately, as soon as I shared that part of my health with me, he told me that he could not date me any longer, that he could not be with a person such as I. Now that to me was a real I'm still working on it.
It's again, it's the mirror thing now. You just, this is why this is so important. When you are confessional, you serve as a mirror.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And people see themselves, and then like what? The fat child with the skinny mind, they close their eyes. It's a denial. Mm-hmm. It's not you. It's their inability to deal with their own stuff.
But it took me a little while to figure that out. But it took my pastor a little while to get me to... Yeah. I mean, I went screaming into his office.
I am wondering about, there's back in Bible school, 12 years ago, I was having a little problem with bulimia. And I was going to the bathroom more than I was studying, and it was deemed to be really... And I kept it all into myself. And one day I was in the kitchen, and I needed a ride to the store to go get some candy bars, because it was just like eating, binging, pooping. And I finally broke down and told one of the girls there, asked her if she'd take me to the store, and she said, you know, I have the same problem too. Mm. And as a result of that, it turned out that she knew of another girl who was having the same problem. Find out there's a whole club full, and it's very spiritual, Bible school, of us who have this problem. Mm-hmm. And so we would get together, we decided we were going to get together, this girl and I, and pray, but we ended up confessing to each other. We weren't getting any better. It finally got to the point where I just avoided her. We weren't getting better. Just confessing wasn't it. And we prayed for God to help us, but... So anyway, I went to the Dean of Women, and that's another full story. She sent me to a so-called Christian counselor who opened me up, and she did Rorschach. She bought tests and had me bring pictures of my ancestors in, and all this and that, you know, and journal my dreams, and she didn't get to the base of it. And it's still a process. I went through deliverance and a number of different things after I left Bible school. But it was a process. But anyway, that problem of confessing, and you can get into like a little group where you're just confessing, but so what? You know, it is not getting better.
That was my
question. What then?
That's a good question in terms of it's not getting better.
You can confess and confess and confess. The hard part is doing something about it.
Tomorrow we're going to talk about affirmations. And the confession comes first. You have to rid yourself before you can be in a position to be renewed. First things first. We are, I think, I call it, excuse me, spiritual constipation. And we need to be cleaned out. And then something magical happens. When we do that, we are receptive to receiving God's blessings, which we're going to talk about in more detail in terms of the affirmations. Sometimes people can get too good about their confessions and not good about the affirmations. This is why it refers back to the AA stuff, because when the fifth steps, they're intentional. On one side, you lay out all your liability, but on the other side, you got, hey, what are some of my good qualities? You see? You don't do one without the other, but you start with confessing your stuff, and then you have to list your positive qualities. It's interesting how we don't have permission to be positive about ourselves. you know. And God made us all unique and beautiful, and we should feel good about ourselves, and certainly we should have permission to acknowledge that, hey, I'm good. If you don't want to take advantage of it, that's your problem, but hey, look what you're missing. I'm beautiful. Self-affirmation, it's not just narcissism, but you've been blessed by God. What's wrong with affirming that? But that's the next step that I wanted to get to. We're really going to stay on the confession now.
I just wanted to comment on that maybe that confession and that group that you got together with, maybe that wasn't the complete answer, but it did lead you somewhere else, which led you somewhere else, which led you to something else. And it was a step.
It just seemed like going to the psychologist was a step backwards because she would open me up. You know, I'd leave her office after an hour, just felt like I was under surgery without being sewn back together, and I'd go back to campus and cry for 2 hours, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was costing me all this money, and it was hard to get there. So I still wonder why God allowed that particular, but it was a step. Like you say, though, because about 2 years down the road, or a year and a half down the road, a very complete, more complete healing. And I'm still not over it. I'm over that part of, but it's still the compulsion to always pacify myself orally, that I can't rest in God and let go of them, you know.
I just wanted to add a piece. I got extremely frustrated that I've been in treatment now, serious treatment, for close to 3 years. And I got to the point where I went to Scott Hosford, the director here, and Pastor Verlon, and I took him by the shoulders and I said, I am so angry at God. And they were very supportive. And if I can, I don't know if it will fit with what you're saying, but one of the things I had to confess was I was extremely angry, frustrated with God because I wanted healing and healing wasn't happening. And the confession for me of letting that out and accepting the possibility that maybe I would never be healed, and accepting that this was the reality, there was a healing in that awareness. Because I really wanted an answer, but then eventually struggling through the book of Job and all this kind of stuff, and especially Harold Kushner's book, When Bad Things Happen to People, accepted the idea that maybe there was not going to be some divine answer, and I had to come to peace with that.
You never finish. In the 12-step program, they'll tell you, you go through all the steps, and then you start all over again.
I find in a process that you go ahead maybe a step or two, and then you go back a step.
That's right.
Sometimes two or three.
Yeah.
Sometimes you even stop.
Yeah. And you can stay in one particular place a long time.
Jump ahead, and then it just seems like that it's never straightforward.
Yeah. And you never finish.
Right.
You never graduate. You just try to experience God's grace where you are at that particular time. It's a journey. It's not the destination. It's enjoying yourself while you're together as a family or as an individual that you want to really recognize. There are a lot of things you don't understand it until many, many years later in your life. And you don't reap the spiritual benefits. I came up in an alcoholic house. And for me, it was just hell. I mean, and some of the syndromes are very much, very much part of me even right now. I'm a light sleeper. Well, I was conditioned that way. I had to be. I was the oldest of 7 children, and I was just conditioned to always to be alert. Something may be happening, and I have to protect my family. And even right now, I'm always listening for something. But I've learned, and my father's, and he still is still a practicing alcoholic, but I've learned to accept him for who he is, and I have learned more spiritual things from him than And he's not, and he doesn't like preachers. He hates me. He's still confused right now why I went into ministry. And I decided that 30 years ago. But it's interesting who you learn the most spiritual things from. It's the very thing that you're trying to be evading or dodge that you learn and grow the most. And my father, my brother, I have a brother who is just strange. He's just a strange person, isn't he, gentlemen? Larry.
Yeah, strange.
Real strange. They both are. Larry's an agnostic at best. My father is a believer. I'm not sure where he is. And I was, here I am, about to be installed in a church. And they bring their stuff right into the church. I mean, they're authentic. And you know, he put it in a Sprite bottle. But I knew what it was.
Jeez.
You know? But I prepared my congregation, and this is why they don't like me, because I'm so honest. He has a father who's the alcoholic. This is my dad.
That's right.
And I'm not ashamed of my dad. It used to be a shame to try to hide behind that sort of thing. But I found that if I can be open and honest, that a lot of other people have dads and mothers or daughters who are very much like that. And they know the embarrassment and that sort of thing. They can identify with you as a human being. See, I saw all that as a liability. But the very thing that you find as a liability can be a spiritual opportunity for you, too. You just have to figure it out. Sometimes it takes a long time to figure that out.
Okay. I realized when you were talking about being a CB-er, a CB person, that that when I do my journaling, I do a lot of complaining. And it hit me that if I have to hide my journal from people that I'm writing about, I'm probably not being real confessional with myself. But part of me wants to believe that that can be my private thing too, you know. So I'm a little confused. Can I still complain? Can I confess and complain?
Yes.
Oh, good.
But don't just confess. Don't just complain and blame. You have to do more than that. That's just the place that you are at a particular time, but you want to move beyond that. And again, this is your journal. You write it for yourself, and anyone who has the audacity to pick it up to read it will read it at their own risk. That's right. And it's risky business to read somebody's journal. I mean, it can be dangerous. But, I mean, so you have permission to be where you are. And as I said the other day, what I find myself guilty of, I put all the garbage in here. Mm-hmm. And we're gonna talk about affirmations. I should be writing the affirmations in here too. Probably more. And it's probably, you know, and that's the real discipline for me, to write down the affirmations, the good stuff. Because that's what I want to hold on to.
Because without the affirmations, there isn't any healing, and that's what this is all about.
Right. Right.
Yes, so it's a matter of having permission to be where you are, but don't stay there.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I say, Tara, you have permission to be disappointed and depressed for 5 minutes or 5 days, and after that, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I have permission to be depressed for the next 3 days. Mm-hmm. And you think I'm out of it in 24 hours. In fact, but you got to give yourself permission to be where you are, because that's where you are.
I was thinking that when you said that the statement, we're never finished. I think for those of us who have perfectionistic tendencies, that's and that brings on the depression and the eating disorders and all that sort of thing. That every time I hear that, it's like I have never heard it before. And I keep thinking I need to have it taped on the inside of my glasses or my imprinted on my contacts or something in front of my eyes at all times, that I'm never going to be finished. Because I keep thinking that there's this magic answer out there, and I'll be fine.
But, you know, I think that since
sitting in churches and hearing tapes and hearing messages on the radio and stuff perpetuates the feeling that you're, you know, well, you take care of this little area, problem area, and you conquer in Christ, you know, you get His grace and you become strengthened in that area, and then it's, the God moves you on to the next little area that He's putting the flashlight on, that He wants to kind of, you know, get you to where you're relying on His grace and moving through that area, so that the old areas, oh wow, now I have victory in that, so we can move along to the next thing, you know, and it's a lifelong process. So I guess it's real discouraging to me to be stuck at the same place for 15, 20 years.
You know what relying on grace is to me is, relying on grace is that when I'm depressed, to know what it is that's wrong. Mm-hmm. Because I believe that I was depressed for about 8 years and I didn't really even know what was wrong. Mm-hmm. I couldn't put a label on it. If you can't put a label on it, you can't deal with it. It's always going to be there. I'm always going to be depressed once in a while. But at least the grace is that I know what it is. I know what it is. That I know what's going on. And you know, it's always going to be there, but I know what it is. And if you know what it is, we say, okay, you're depressed. And you can say, okay, well, I know what's wrong with me now. Now I can get on with it, you know?
Yeah. But you know what's good for me and listening to you, like that remark, is that I know that even though I am depressed occasionally, I have some say about whether or not I want to remain depressed. That's up to me. If I want to stay down in the dumps, I can mope and just, you know, stay there for days or weeks or months or even years. But I trust that same grace will reveal it to me eventually. So even if I can't figure it out at the moment, I still can decide that I'm going to be happy today because I have enough good stuff going on in my life to give thanks and praise to God and just be aware of those blessings and keep, you know, a positive outlook. And I find that really helps me to be able to get through the day and greet people with a smile and, you know, just to be real upbeat. Knowing that still there's something going on, but it no need to be moping over because I don't know what it is yet, so I don't know what to do about it yet.
And when you're in that type of state, you have to be careful because people really don't want to be around you then.
Yeah.
So, oh, here she comes. Oh, you know, turn around and go the other way. And I'm like that sometimes. When I'm in my mood, and I go off somewhere by myself because I don't want to contaminate the people I'm traveling with. And we do it with children. All right, you have permission to go to your space, but you're not going to put that negative stuff into the family around the dinner table. We won't permit that. But you have permission to be negative or depressed or whatever. You certainly have permission, you know. And I will go away. I mean, if I see negative people coming, that's one of the most difficult things about being a pastor. You have to be nice to people all the time. But there are some regulars out there, complaining, blamers, people, and that's all they ever do. And it may not be good pastoral care on my part, but I don't want to be contaminated. So you have to be careful. Now, when I'm hurting and I have a lot of pain, I'm very intentional about spreading my stuff around to different people. I don't go dump everything on John Ehrman. I'm not going to do that because she'll run from me sooner or later. Yeah, I'll spread it around to this person. So that's why you have to, you travel with a lot of people. So you spread your stuff around a lot of people. And then you receive from a lot of people. So that's the way it's supposed to be. But we have permission to be in a bad mood or depressed. But we have a responsibility to ourselves and to others. We have a responsibility for putting some limitation in terms of our depression or negative. We have some responsibility in terms of sharing that in a wide enough network so that we don't just override somebody with our stuff. Because we're gonna travel together for a long time, so we want to have a healthy relationship as we travel.
Yeah.
take this one more, then we're going to have to close it out. You have a question, Holly?
No. Oh, I'd like to respond a little to what you say, because I have in my own family, you know, there are situations, and I'm not saying they're outside of the power of God for healing, where people cannot say, I'm going to allow myself 3 days, but there's a chemical imbalance for a lot of they are.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That is a life, for their whole life, they can do something about correcting it, but it isn't by their outlook.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that right?
That's correct. That's what I know.
And you know, one thing I'm curious about, and I'm not going to look in your journal, but I'm going to start a journal, and do you have any little directive or warning or anything inside the front cover for those who glance at it?
No, I don't. But I have, of course, because everyone in the family know I have a journal. And they know that it's risky for them to do it.